It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
They gathered outside of Cambridge City Hall, more than 200 gay couples who wanted to be first to apply for licenses to legally marry in Massachusetts, and their supporters.
It's very personal and it's huge. It's way beyond the two of us.
On this night, the opponents of gay marriage were vastly outnumbered. By afternoon, the first gay couples had married, including the seven whose lawsuit had led the state's highest court to legalize same-sex marriage.
What do we want? What do we want? What do we want?
The forces opposed to gay marriage had battled for months in the streets, in the legislature, in the courts. Today, they effectively conceded defeat and withdrew. In the end, the imagery of same-sex unions, as much as the substance of the issue, may determine whether same-sex marriage becomes a decisive factor in politics.
I now pronounce you fully and legally married.
When Americans see images like these, will they be repulsed or will they see two people in love? This is Ron Claiborne for Nightline in Boston.
Sandy Rios with you. That even sounds strange to my ears. That was a report in 2004 from Nightline. You can see how things have changed, even the way that commentator on Nightline positioned that the question at the end. It was 2004. Massachusetts was already on the cutting edge of LGBT rights, much of New England the same way, but not a single state had legalized same-sex marriage, and it was a battle for the centuries. I remember it well because I was there. I remember speaking at Faneuil Hall. I remember speaking at Boston Commons with Cardinal O'Malley, trying to rally people to stop it. And yet, the people of Massachusetts could not stop it. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court was the one that actually legalized it. It's all very kind of murky. Mitt Romney was governor during that time. It's murky about his role as well. And so, I think many of our hearts just sank because we knew that this was the precursor of things to come. Little did we know what kinds of things would come from that. I think many people thought that by embracing homosexual marriage in Massachusetts, that things would at last settle down, that gay persons would be allowed to legally unite, share their property, have families just like heterosexual couples, and all would be well. But that's really not the story of what's happened in Massachusetts. And the next guest who joins us knows better than I what's happened in his home state. It's Andrew Beckwith. Andrew is the president of Massachusetts Family Institute, who were on the front lines of fighting gay marriage back in 2004 and still now find themselves with their hands full of plenty more fights regarding that issue. Andrew, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Sandy.
Hey, Andrew, were you there in 2004? Is that your home state?
It is my home state, but in 2004 I was actually in the Marine Corps, so it was in between Virginia and then Okinawa, Japan. So I was not in country, actually, for a lot of that fight. I didn't come back until late 2007 when I was done with my service. And at that point, the sort of agenda of the sexual revolution had already moved on to transgenderism. Basically, as soon as same-sex marriage was secured, there was a push to add the term gender identity to existing state non-discrimination laws, and that became partially successful, actually, as far back as 2011, when gender identity was added to all the segments of law except for public accommodations because of this concern about bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, and places like that.
Before we get into the specifics of that stuff, because I do want to talk to you about all of that, When you were growing up in Massachusetts, you know, when I think of Massachusetts, I think of there's that old movie, like of the 30s, Our Town or something like that. But there's a very, conservative picture of an old guard, another world. Massachusetts having one of the best constitutions of any of the 50 states, being kind of a bastion of thought, of intellect, of Christian teaching, too, way, way back before your time and mine, too. But when you were growing up in Massachusetts, was it a liberal state then, Andrew? Did you see signs or any kind of hints that something like this might come to pass?
Well, you know, I mean, I grew up in a small town. My father was a mechanic. My mother's a public school teacher. Went to church every Sunday. And, you know, I think I was somewhat insulated from the growing progressivism. And it wasn't until I went to law school, actually, at the University of Minnesota, which was renamed Walter Mondale Hall before I graduated. It was really made clear to me what sort of the academic elites have in store for our country.
I'm just curious. I know I'm asking you a personal question, so forgive me, but I must. I know when my soul got gripped with the intersection of political issues, so-called political, and moral issues, and it was the abortion issue. I saw an abortion brochure in 1973 when I was quite young, and the images just burned my soul. I'd never seen anything like it, and that birthed the passion in me. So, Andrew, you grow up, you're into the Marines. You've probably seen some pretty ugly things. You've committed to your country, but what about this issue? These issues and related to this kind of was the catalyst for you taking on leading Massachusetts Family Institute.
Well, I mean, for me, actually, the abortion issue is one of them as well. I grew up not really thinking about that issue a lot. It was never really talked about in church. And when I was in high school, the civics teacher was pro-abortion. We had sort of that myth of Malthusian overpopulation and all that. So I was essentially pro-abortion until I was most of the way through college. I just happened one day to pick up a Focus on the Family magazine and read an article by Dr. Dobson about, you know, people believe that we're Christians and we believe in the Bible, believe that God's word is true. We cannot be pro-abortion. We must be pro-life. It's the logical consequence of that. And, you know, when I finished reading that article, it was like a revelation to me. I'd never really thought it through before. It'd never been discussed or explained to me. And so that kind of started me on a journey to explore and try to really understand these things we're being presented with. And that helped me when I was in law school as well to think through from a perspective of faith and as a young husband and father what these challenges are to raising a family. It's a very different environment than when I grew up in. Parents can no longer trust sort of the institutions that we used to be able to entrust our children to, whether it's public schools, even colleges, what's on TV, the libraries. And now we see I get calls from parents whose children are being rushed through gender transitions by the medical professions at some of the most elite hospitals in the Commonwealth. It's very troubling, and we're just trying to take it sort of one battle at a time and do the best we can. And this is where we find ourselves right now.
You know, while you were still serving the country, I remember a story well. Boy, do I ever remember this well. This was in Massachusetts. It was a man named David Parker who had a son who was like 5 years old in kindergarten. And this is, of course, before gay marriage was embraced, 2 years before. And it came to his attention that they were telling the kindergarten students about homosexuality. And David was just a dad doing his job, his business, not thinking, probably never guessing, probably a lot like you, I'm guessing, never dreaming what was actually happening in public schools. And so he went to the school board and stood, and in his own way, with the knowledge that he had at that time, said, "You can't do that with my child without my permission." And basically, he was arrested. He was pulled out of that meeting and arrested, and I don't think he ever, I'm not sure, I think they did put him in jail at least for one night, and that really was kind of a precursor to what we're actually seeing now, don't you think, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's a very bad First Circuit federal court decision from that incident, the Parker case, which basically says you know, parents' rights are very limited when it comes to directing education of children in a public school setting, and that their options are essentially to send them to a private school or homeschool, which is awful because, again, my mother was a public school teacher. I grew up going to public school. Parents used to be able to trust that public schools would, if not reinforce the morality of being taught at home, at least not actively undermine it. That's no longer the case.
What I'd like to do, before we get into the specifics of what you're seeing, there is going to be a question three on the ballot this coming election day, this midterm election day in Massachusetts. And let's just talk about what that's about. Then we're going to go backwards and talk about what's practically happening in the streets and in the schools as a result of this bathroom law. It was passed in 2016, right?
That's right.
And what was it? What was that all about? What did that say? I mean, we're familiar. Most people are familiar with these so-called bathroom laws, but what was Massachusetts' specific law guaranteeing?
Right. I just need to back up again briefly to 2011 when the term gender identity was inserted into existing non-discrimination law. So basically laws that say it's unlawful to discriminate against someone on the basis of sex or race or creed or religion or ethnicity. The term gender identity was added to that list in 2011, covering education, employment, financing, and housing. It did not cover and was not added to at that time public accommodations, which would be most places of business, because most places of business have bathrooms or, in some cases, showers or locker rooms, or if they're a homeless shelter, they're living accommodations that are single sex. That was not covered in the 2011 law intentionally. It was actually taken out of the bill before it was passed because there's a recognition at the time, at least, that this would be a problem to open up private spaces that are designed on the basis of anatomy, biological sex, for males or females, to this very vague and broad gender identity definition. And that's something I think people oftentimes don't understand. They think that if someone identifies as transgender, it means they've had, the total surgery. But it really doesn't. In fact, the way the definition works under the law, they don't need to have surgery, they don't need to have hormones, they don't need a medical diagnosis. They don't even have to consistently hold a particular identity. It boils down to, as the law puts it, the sincerely held identity of the individual. Which means, as the law that was passed in 2016, which then added gender identity to public accommodations, kind of completing the effort that was partially successful in 2011, at this point, under existing Massachusetts law, any man at any time can enter any women's facility, bathroom, locker room, shower, changing facility, and no one can tell them to leave so long as the individual identifies or claims to identify, rather, as female. And we've seen just in the past week, there was a 10-year-old girl who was in the girls' bathroom at a Target in Woburn, and a man with got into the bathroom and was trying to open the stall door. Unfortunately, he did not get into the stall. They terrified this little girl, but he's allowed to be in there. The police actually said to the dad that technically the guy did not commit a crime by being in that bathroom, and they're right because of the way this law works, but it put that 10-year-old girl at risk.
That's unbelievable. And of course, you know that American Family Association has been boycotting Target for the last more than a year. Trying to get people to boycott it, to force them to change their policy. But, of course, they are subject to state laws, and Massachusetts has a very bad law. This question three, I just quickly before we take this break, in case people tune out for this segment, you're trying to repeal that bathroom bill, bottom line.
The law was passed in 2016. We collected over 50,000 signatures two summers ago, which allowed us to put it on the ballot this November to repeal it.
Okay, so that's the issue in Massachusetts. If you know people there, it's coming up on the ballot on Election Day, midterm Election Day, November 6th, and that is to repeal the bathroom law. It's no on three is the slogan that Andrew Beckwith's group is using. And we're going to talk more about that when we return, so please stay tuned. There are stories that you would not believe, and we're going to flesh as many out as we can about the repercussions of this kind of thinking, what's actually happened since the legalizing of same-sex marriage. It's only gotten worse. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We What does Massachusetts Question 3 mean to you? It means any man who says he is a woman can enter a woman's locker room, dressing room, or bathroom at any time, even convicted sex offenders. And if you see something suspicious and say something to authorities, you could be the one arrested and fined up to $50,000. Vote no on 3. This bathroom bill puts our privacy and safety at risk. It goes too far.
Wow. So this is Massachusetts, and this is a proposal to overturn their bathroom law coming up. Massachusetts, the most, arguably, the most liberal state in the union when it comes to transgender progressivism, LGBT rights. Certainly they were the first, if not the most progressive. My guest is Andrew Beckwith. He is the president of Massachusetts Family Institute, and he's helping lead this initiative to turn back this bathroom law. It's a no vote, no on 3. Vote no on 3. And you can, by the way, we'll put information on our Facebook page, and you can pass it on to your friends in Massachusetts to help them. Some of them. Is it possible not to know about this and live in Massachusetts right now, Andrew?
Well, I mean, surprisingly, there are people that aren't aware of what Question 3 is about, and if they have heard of it, they, you know, they may not have heard what the law actually does. So that is sort of the main thrust of the campaign that I'm working with, which is to educate people about the very real privacy and safety concerns caused by this law. And you know, as we've said, you know, in the campaign materials, the repeal of this law really isn't about the underlying issue of transgenderism so much as it is the privacy and safety. Because the concern is that, again, any man can abuse this law if they merely claim to identify as female, and the law is so broad there's no way to police that. So that's what we're trying to stop. And, for example, the legislature, when they passed this law, there was a proposed amendment that would have exempted level 2 and 3 sex offenders from using this law to enter women's spaces, which would seem to be a common sense restriction of the law, and the legislature voted that amendment down overwhelmingly because they just demonstrates their concern is not about the privacy and safety of the majority of Massachusetts citizens. And when people hear that that's part of this law and that people can be fined up to $50,000, if I, as a dad, stand in front of the or outside the girls' locker room waiting for my daughter to change after swim lessons at the local Y, and I see a man start to walk into the women's locker room where my daughter is changing, if I stop that man, I could be fined $50,000 and up to a year in jail if that man claims to identify as female. And there's a breaking story out of Andover, Massachusetts, Merrimack College. There is a level 3 registered sex offender who has a long history of both sexual assault and lewdness, so criminal record that makes him a registered sex offender, and a number of aliases, some of which are female. So he has a history of claiming a female gender identity. He got kicked off of the Merrimack College campus for trespass, and we don't have the details of that yet, but here's a perfect example of someone that this law allows to abuse this concept of gender identity to enter women's spaces.
You know, I'm going to repeat what you just said because it's really kind of hard to comprehend, and that is that the Massachusetts bathroom bill lets any man who claims to identify as a woman enter women-only spaces, including men who are sex offenders, registered sex offenders.
That's right.
And also, and then as you just said, if you try to stop it, if you're a woman who tries to stop them, you could face up to $50,000 in fine or a year in jail. That is incomprehensible, Andrew. I mean, I can't imagine that there's not going to be a line of men, dads like you, going to prison over something like this.
Yes. Well, and it gets even crazier than that. There's a scenario that came out of Milton, Mass. Earlier this year that was beyond even what I could have imagined when we were talking about what this law might do, and that is there was a spa owner, a female spa owner, who declines to give a Brazilian wax, a bikini wax, which is a rather intimate procedure. I won't go into the details, but it involves waxing sort of the private space, general area of the person, and a man requested that service. He's still anatomically male, has male anatomy. He's very clear about that in his request. And the female spa owner and spa workers declined to perform that service for him. And so because this man, again, claims to identify as female, he brought a discrimination claim with the Attorney General's Office against this female spa owner. demanding that they wax his genitals. And if this law is not repealed, he will win that claim.
You know, Andrew, you just debated this. This is really fresh. I was reading, this article is dated October 17th. I don't know when your debate was. Between Casey Suvredini, co-chairman of the
right.
Yes on 3 campaign,
right.
On this very, was this limited to this wax case, or was it on the gender identity law in general?
It was on the repeal effort in general, and of course the other side, the Yes on 3 campaign keeps saying there's been no incidences, nothing is happening, there's no problem, nothing to see here. And so we keep bringing up situations where there have been problems, and this is one that they can't deny because her co-chair, Mason Dunn, actually was the attorney who helped this man who identifies female file the claim. So they know very well what this law does, and they're trying to enforce it.
You know, there was a time, this may be before you were involved, honestly, this has been going on for decades, you know, Andrew, this push to normalize different sexual proclivities, a long time. And there was a time when the gay community did not embrace transgenderism, did not want to fold them into their tent because they didn't think that people would ever accept drag queens, cross-dressing males, all the other categories that you might describe. But that all changed, and I think what you said earlier is really the fruit of the original passage of legalizing gay marriage. The next step really was this. It's like, what other horizon, what other barrier can we break down? And so the inference that I'm making is that homosexual peoples are now siding with transgender, but I wonder if that's actually true. Surely there are homosexual persons who don't think this is a good idea, especially when it gets so far as to share bathrooms indiscriminately. Even with children. I mean, a lot of them have children or care about children. So how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, well, that's true. And there have been, there's a woman who was at, can't even remember off the top of my head, but she's was the first lesbian reinstated after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed to the military service. And she opposes this type of legislation because she rightfully concludes that it is it's a problem for biological women of any sexual orientation to have anatomical males, regardless of their gender identity, in spaces designed for women to be comfortable and private and safe. I think the reality is when a male anatomy, a male body, comes into a woman's locker room, most women in there aren't going to really care how that male identifies. But they are going to care that there is now a male body in a space that's designed and intended for female bodies. And their voices should be heard rather than silenced. And this law silences their voices and has pretty severe criminal penalties for women speaking out.
It's just amazing. You know, I don't, you know, I'm not there, but I do follow what happens in your state, Andrew. And I know that you had a recent, Scott, our friend who ran for governor in your state, a conservative
Scott
Christian
Lively.
Pastor. Yeah, Scott Lively. My impression was that conservatives and certainly Christians / conservatives in that state have been energized in the last year or so. Is that a wrong perception, or do you sense that they're bringing that energy into something like this too, repealing, to say no on 3?
Well, we certainly hope to energize a broad spectrum of people in Massachusetts, conservative, moderates, and even liberals. I mean, true feminists should be against this type of legislation because it says that the meaning of woman is simply how someone feels on the inside, and that men can take over that. And we've seen that in sports, with high school or college sports. I had a dad call me whose daughter made it onto a varsity athletic team for a big statewide or regional tournament, and she was very excited. And then her spot was taken by a anatomical male classmate who identified as female and bumped her off the varsity squad. But because this was a regional tournament and not tied to schools per se, that was public accommodation, and there's nothing that could be done because under the law, it would have been illegal discrimination for this tournament organization to require that the girls' team be comprised of actual females. So we see women lose when this legislation is.
And that's happening nationwide, as you know. I mean, there's so many examples of transitioning males into female, or who claim they're females, you know, winning or getting spots on teams or winning track and field races, or, you know, fill in the blanks. And it really is just, it's just something really wrong with this picture. That's all I can say. When you debated last week, who was your audience?
Well, last week that was on WBUR, so it's a sort of Boston public radio. And it was a radio debate. So we were in the studio with two moderators, and I and Casey. So the audience was the folks who listen to public radio.
Okay, see, so you didn't get, you couldn't. It's a shame, though. You almost wish you could get an audience so that you could actually see their response. Of course, audiences can be stacked.
Sure.
But what's your sense of it? I mean, really, what is your sense of it? Do you think this thing has a possibility of being repealed?
Absolutely. I mean, again, when people know what this law actually does, they're ready to vote against it. So it's just a question of us getting the messaging out. Of course, the local media, by and large, is against us. We're outfunded by the other side, but we feel like we've got common sense and truth on our side, so we're pressing that advantage. Doing another debate on the popular AM channel, 10:30 WBC, on tomorrow night. And that's going to be a live sort of town hall debate. So we'll get to see some of the audience reaction there. And I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, absolutely. Were there any, have you gotten past the shock phase? Like when you were debating with Casey Sifridini, I've debated when I used to debate these issues all the time on television, Barney Frank and all the human rights campaign, GLSEN experts. That's what I actually did all the time. It was at the time I was still shockable. You could still surprise me. Not so much anymore. So I'm wondering, when you were debating Casey, were there any moments where you just, it was so incredulous, you just couldn't believe that she was actually embracing the thing she was advocating?
Well, they don't want to talk about the real issues, and they don't want to answer the tough questions. So when I was trying to pin Casey down on this spa complaint that her co-chair helped file, she didn't want to talk about that. She wanted to talk instead about how she was afraid that she would be kicked out of a grocery store trying to buy oregano on the way home from work, which is preposterous in Massachusetts. And if that did happen after this law is repealed, the existing laws already cover that aspect of a discrimination claim, which has been very clear from our local Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination. So it's ironic. They accuse us of fear-mongering when we talk about bathrooms and locker rooms, even though there are examples of that happening. And yet they're the ones who really are the fear-mongers, saying there's going to be all these horrible, frankly preposterous discrimination incidents, which they don't have any specifics either. They're just throwing out these claims. And again, this is Massachusetts. No one's going to be kicking someone out of a grocery store who's trying to buy oregano because of how they're dressing.
Yeah. You know, when I was debating, the two things that they would not talk about, that either they would change the subject or respond, but they would do whatever they could to shut down the discussion, were healthcare risks and any mention or story about ex-gay persons. That was like the cross to Dracula. That's something they could not fight back on. And then I think about what's happened to Dr. Paul Church out of Massachusetts. I'm sure you know him well.
I do.
Who has lost his job for simply speaking to his colleagues about the health risks.
He's a urologist, so he would know.
Yeah, he would know. But those are the things that they cannot stand, because there's just no pushback on that. But I think the thing, honestly, Andrew, those people are all grown-ups. So that's bad enough. But when it comes to what they're doing to our children, even as I was preparing this to talk to you, as many years as I've been doing this, I wept when I saw some of the things that I saw. Let's talk about what's happening in public school, how they're actually laying the groundwork for embracing this kind of ridiculousness. I have in my hand like three handouts. I think these are sent from you, although they're from the schools. These, I believe, are for preschools. The gender unicorn? Maybe you could tell me. Is this preschool information?
We've heard it's been used as early as preschool, and it's not surprising when you look at it. It's very, you know, colorful and cartoonish. But they're introducing these concepts of gender fluidity to children at a very young age, and you know they don't want parental input on this if there's any objection to it. And you may, I'm sure you're aware of the case out of Decatur, Georgia, that ADF is bringing to national attention, where I think it's a 5-year-old girl, kindergarten girl, goes into the girls' bathroom at school, and a boy who is identifying as gender fluid, a classmate of hers, comes in and violently assaults her sexually. And the school is, doesn't want to talk about it, doesn't want to explain to the mom or protect the daughter or do anything like that. And the parents didn't even know that this was the policy in the school until the sexual assault took place.
Actually, we're going to talk about that when we come back. And I want to sort of give people an idea of what these illustrations are like for children and really how they are propagandizing, as they have been really for decades, I have to tell you, Andrew. It goes all the way back to it's elementary. That was the first piece of propaganda that the left produced for public schools. I'll never forget it. It was jaw-dropping, but it was mild compared to what we're seeing now. So stay tuned. My guest is Andrew Beckwith. He's the president of Massachusetts Family Institute. By the way, if you're in Massachusetts or know someone, vote no on 3 on Election Day. Vote no on 3. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
My daughter stated to me that she was in class and she asked the teacher if she could go to the bathroom. And the teacher said yes. So she was in the bathroom, and she was pulling up her pants when one of her classmates came in the bathroom, a little boy. She tried to leave out of the bathroom. The little boy pushed her against the bathroom stall, basically pinned her up against there. She asked him to stop. He wouldn't. He took his fingers, and he was penetrating her through her pants. And she asked him to stop and stated several times that it hurt. He refused. Once he was done, she went to class. I asked her if she told anyone about it. She started crying, saying, "No, Mama, I didn't tell nobody, but I didn't ask him to come in the bathroom with me. I didn't know he was gonna do that." And I told her that it's not her fault. It was just not her fault. He should not have been in that bathroom.
That was a woman named Pasha, and that's Decatur, Georgia. That's what Andrew was just referring to. Same but different. We're discussing Massachusetts today, but in Decatur, Georgia, the school district, under their superintendent, David Dude, decided to implement this bathroom policy, same but different, where boys that identify as girls can go into the girls' bathroom, and that's what happened. And this is what happened to Pasha's daughter, and the story is even more, it's hard to listen to, and it's even worse because Pasha went to the superintendent, she went to the teacher. They told her there was nothing they could do about it, nothing they were going to do about it. She asked for the boy to be removed from class. They refused. And then after that, the Department of Health, Child Services came to her door, she thought, to help. But instead, they accused her of being responsible for the incident. That's how bad it is in public schools. Andrew is... I'm sure that story shocked you, and yet that's what we're setting our children up for in all these public schools, aren't we?
Yeah, again, you're right. It is hard to listen to as a father with young daughters. That breaks your heart and makes one angry, as it should. And the question is, why was that boy in the girls' bathroom to begin with? And it's because of laws and policies like the one we're trying to repeal here in Massachusetts.
Well, and the most shocking thing to me, Andrew, is that this mom went to the superintendent. I think the truth is, from my understanding in this report, he never has even discussed it with her. The teacher, I believe, or the principal of the school told her there was nothing they could do about it, and she just have to, basically, you have to live with it. It's just the way it is.
And this we've is seen the, that repeatedly from bureaucrats and legislators here in Massachusetts, that it's, I just have to get, in fact, I've been told, that when I say, what do we, when I've debated this at the legislature when they're passing this law, I said, what do we tell the young women who are not comfortable with boys coming in their locker rooms? And I've been told they just need to get over it. Our state attorney general, Maura Healey, said that people who have a problem with this law should just hold it. And that is what we're dealing with. Zero sympathy, zero understanding. It's pushing this agenda forward, silencing women, penalizing parents if they try and protect their children. It's all ideologically motivated, and there's no room for any objection or questioning.
You know, Andrew, I saw this years ago when my son was in middle school. It was when I first started seeing it. I lived in an affluent suburb outside of Chicago, and it wasn't about sex. It was about very strange curricula. They started out pushing just the oddest things. It was before this Heather Has Two Mommies. It was this was witchcraft and things like that. And this was a group of parents that rose up to say, we don't want this. That's what they were assigning the kids to read. Lots of stuff like this. And the parents were, you know, highly educated, many of them themselves, professors, doctors, lawyers, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter. It wasn't like the teachers were better. They were the educated ones, and they could pat the parents on the head and tell them to go back to the farm. This did not matter. The bottom line with that battle was that the children were not allowed to even leave the class. The parents got nowhere with those complaints. My point is that this is an epidemic with school boards across the nation. The left has stacked the school boards. They have totally co-opted the National Education Association. They did that more than two decades ago. And so there is an agenda, and their agenda is more important than your children. Absolutely. It just is.
And that's why we had to get this on the statewide ballot, take it directly to the voters, bypass the legislature, bypass the administrative bureaucracy, and go straight to the voters, the parents, the grandparents, aunts and uncles, who can vote to preserve the privacy and safety that we had in this Commonwealth up until 2 years ago.
Yeah, so just to repeat, because we want to be very clear, it is on the midterm election day when the voters of Massachusetts will consider repealing their bathroom bill, and you need to vote no on three. Vote no on question three. And so I started this earlier, but let's go back to it, because you sent me an illustration of what's being presented to small children. And I want to describe a couple of these. One is a gingerbread man, and it's called the gingerbread person. And it has a little heart, and the heart is lit.
Gingerbread.
Yeah, what did I say? I thought I said that. Gingerbread person, yes. Yeah. Okay, so there's the brain in this gingerbread figure, and it's called identity. There's the heart, little picture of a heart. That's called the orientation. And then there is the sex organ section of the gingerbread man. Maybe you didn't know he had one, but he does in this illustration. And that's called the sex. So it's gender identity, gender expression, biological sex, and sexual orientation. That's one illustration. And then here's one that I think kind of spells it out verbally. And it's called a spectrum. It says, our sexuality and gender identity aren't set in stone. In fact, people's identities can be fluid. The spectrum can help you visualize how you feel at any given time. Mark how you identify today on each line, but don't feel limited. It's okay to mark something different tomorrow. What's behind this, Andrew? What are they trying to do?
Well, I mean, that's an example of the gender fluidity that apparently was expressed by that male student that violated the young girl in Decatur, Georgia. And this is just inserting chaos into the minds and hearts and ultimately bodies of our children, introducing these ideas. There was a middle school in Beverly, Massachusetts, where someone sent me a picture in the hallway they had. It was a form you could fill out that was similar to the one you're seeing there, the gingerbread person or the gender unicorn, a different variant, where you can put down these colorful smiley stickers somewhere on these five or six different spectrum lines for identity, orientation, sex assigned at birth. They don't even want to talk about biology or anatomy anymore. It's sex you were assigned at birth as if that were arbitrary somehow. And it's really sad. There was a whole bulletin board in the hallway of middle school students who were, you know, literally all over the map on this, because that's what they're being suggested to explore and experiment. And then even the teachers did the forms themselves. The teachers were a little more reserved, but even they had some sort of questioning experimentation. So this is an aggressive ideology being foisted on our children.
And I believe that
they're the ones who will suffer ultimately.
Oh, absolutely. We're already seeing, we wonder what's happening to this generation, and it's not hard to figure out. I say that every day at the beginning of my show. There's a pre-recorded, I was a debate I did about this, and our kids are the product of public schools, and what can we expect? That they're polling the way they've been brainwashed. So, but there the other issue that Massachusetts was on the cutting edge, Andrew, and this was a few years ago, maybe it was 2011, I don't know, when kids who were identifying as a different gender than biological, the teachers in Massachusetts, now this is around the country, but I believe your state was first, were assigning those children names that comported with what they thought they might be on that particular day. They were allowed to go to the restroom that comported with what they thought they might be, and they weren't allowed to tell the parents about this, to report
that's right,
it to
that
the
came
home.
Came out in February of 2013, I believe, with an 11-page gender identity guidance document from the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education that it had made it onto national media because it was really wild. Now it's become sort of standard operating procedure in a lot of schools, unfortunately. But yes, one of the aspects was that if a student didn't feel safe, and they're using the term safe all the time, didn't feel safe talking about their gender identity to their parents, that teachers and administrators were prohibited from alerting the parents to the fact that their, you know, 13-year-old son is coming to school, putting his backpack in his locker, pulling out a dress, and going by a female name and identity all day long. So we really see the state and the guise of this ideology coming in between parents and children.
Yes, and I also, Andrew, I have to add that this, a lot of this came about because the Obama Education Department put out a paper or a executive order, whatever that category was, that all school districts...
Dear colleague letter. Yeah.
Dear colleague. That all schools had to embrace this around the country or be threatened
all
with funds.
All schools receive federal funds, yeah.
Yes, yes. And so that's what caused all of this and is still happening and has not been reversed as it should have been. I do want to give some hope. In that Decatur, Georgia story that was so shattering we heard a few minutes ago, the U.S. Department of Education under President Trump, the Office for Civil Rights, is launching an investigation into that incident. And also, just in the last 24 hours, I'm sure you've heard this, Andrew, the Trump administration out of HHS, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, is changing the definition of sex and gender to define it on a biological basis that is clear, grounded in science, objective, and administrable. That's earth-shattering, don't you think? Groundbreaking.
Well, it is now. It would have been sort of the status quo even 3 years ago. But I mean, the good news is that the Dear Colleague letter, I believe, was rescinded by the Obama, by the Trump administration. And so now they're moving to clarify this sort of department-wide so we don't have the chaos and confusion that we saw as a result of that letter. In Massachusetts, we have our own State Department of Education pushing this agenda at the state level, which, again, is why we've got to take this to the voters on the ballot in November. Vote no on question three and try to preserve the privacy and modesty and innocence of our children.
Andrew, I happen to know that Massachusetts used to have some of the finest, if not the finest, school system in the nation. There is a math professor from there. I can't think of her last name in the moment. Her first name is Sandra. I've interviewed her more than once.
Stotsky?
Yes, Stotsky. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And she led, you know, Massachusetts in, I'm sure you know all this, in giving, creating the highest standards of any state in the union in terms of test scores and everything. But what's happened to that since all of this?
Well, I know there's a big fight over Common Core because the imposition of Common Core onto the state education paradigm threatened to undo a lot of that. And my wife and I have the are fortunate enough to have the ability to homeschool our children, so I don't know exactly what is going on when it comes to the Common Core right now, the federal standards and all that in public schools. I know there's been a lot of pushback because Massachusetts was doing better before this was being kind of foisted upon us. I tend to focus more on the mandated sex ed that's been put up for votes multiple times in
the state house. But I think the obvious, even if we don't have something quantifiable, I think the point has to be made that whereas the children of Massachusetts used to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic, and they learned it well, and they were taught strictly and had very high standards, this is bound to show up when they start, you know, filling children and sexualizing their minds before their time. It's time, their time to awaken. It's going to affect how they perform in school. This is a tragedy on so many levels. If you're in Massachusetts or if you're anywhere around, you have friends there, you'll want to send them information. We'll put it on our Facebook page today. No on three. You can also go to Keep Ma Safe. Keep Ma Safe. KeepMaSafe for information about this battle that Andrew Beckwith and the Massachusetts Family Institute is leading. Andrew, it's a pleasure to meet you by phone. God bless you and all that you're doing for Massachusetts, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Yeah, good talking.
All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.